From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Wales international footballer Ched Evans has been jailed for 5 years after being convicted of rape. His co-defendant, Port Vale's Clayton McDonald, has been cleared. From Carnarvon Crown Court, Nick Martin reports.
Ched Evans sobbed in the dock when the jury found him guilty of rape. His friend, Clayton McDonald, was cleared moments earlier. The pair were out drinking in Rill back in May 2011 when they met a 19-year-old woman. The court heard how she was so drunk she could hardly walk, but she was taken back to a nearby hotel where Ched Evans raped her. The former Sheffield United and Wales international striker was told he had a promising career and that it was now over.
Anders Breivik has been describing how he calmly killed 69 people on a holiday island in Norway. Survivors were in tears in the courtroom as he detailed exactly what happened on Utøya Island in July. Police in Pakistan say there's no chance of finding any survivors after a plane crash. A Bohjan Air jet, which was carrying more than 120 people, came down just before it was due to land in Islamabad. David Cameron's resisted pressure to call for the cancellation of the Bahrain Grand Prix as protests over human rights abuses continue in the country. The Prime Minister says it's a matter for the Formula One authorities. Mahfoud Amara, the author of the Sport, Politics and Society in the Arab World book, says the royal family there will want the event to go ahead.
For the regime and the ruling elite, of course, this is an opportunity to regain some political legitimacy and to regain credibility as an economic partner in the region.
The UK is committing a further £10 billion to the International Monetary Fund's bailout war chest. Britain will give the extra cash amid growing fears of a new economic crisis in Europe. And the price of petrol's reached an all-time high. The AA says a litre of unleaded now costs on average £1.42 a litre. That's the latest. I'm Barry
Bristol Weaver. Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is Tim Leeman, Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, it started this week, but why does it take a foreign TV channel to give Julian Assange his own talk show? Plus, police are balloting over the right to strike and the biggest attempt to change their paying conditions for 30 years. Kevin Phillips is along from the local police federation to explain why. And what with all the changes to the education system, what is this meaning for young mums? Claire Humphreys is here from local schools for local children to share with us some of the dilemmas of the modern mum. Plus, Black Avon and Somerset police officer turned driving instructor Phil Mattis has written a book about the state of the family in 21st century Bristol. He joins me to explain why he left the police and what prompted him to write the book. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 degrees Celsius and some light rain. If it's anything like last week, it might be a bit heavy. That's what it was supposed to be light last week, but wasn't. Anyway, this weekend, highs of 13 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday and wetter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 again, some sunny spells, wetter and windier in the middle of the week. Next weekend, that's the 28th and 29th of April, highs of 10 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, time to introduce this week's guest, and joining us this week is Tim Leeman, Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston. Hi Tim, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks, Tony.
Now, first of all, what brought you into politics, Tim?
Well, I got into local politics, really, through my grandfather, who was a councillor here from about 1946 to 74, when it became Avon. And I was interested in public service, and it caught my attention. First, I found myself delivering leaflets for the Lib Dem Party, and next thing you know, I'm a Liberal Democrat councillor in King's Weston, which was a former sort of dormitory area of Bristol serving Avonmouth.
So were you press ganged into it then?
I was press ganged, Tony, yes. No, willingly, of course. And it's been an interesting 2 years. I was elected in 2010 May, And since then I've been fairly active, but the council is an interesting place, there's no doubt about it.
Why that particular, why the Lib Dem party? I imagine your grandfather wasn't a Liberal, was he?
Yes, he was. He was a Liberal and then a member of the Citizen Party, and I was obviously born, as we all are, into a Liberal democracy, and that was my way in, really, and I felt it was the party that I agreed with. I wouldn't say I agree with all policies and decision making, but... And that's essentially where I come from.
Certainly now, Lib Dems are in a bit of a dilemma because they're seen by many people as propping up, essentially, what is a Conservative government with Conservative policies. Many of the policies that are being rolled out are not those that people who voted for Lib Dems around the country actually voted for at all.
We retain our Liberal Democrat identity and credentials within the coalition. In fact, a lot of the policies that will come through, particularly in helping the low paid, I'm actually benefited from this myself, in terms of less than £10,000 a year and being taken out of tax, for example, help with the pupil premium, for example.
Well,
these are Lib Dem, ideas, and we're pushing them through.
The other people that benefit, of course, are the super rich, the millionaires. There was nothing about that in the manifesto of either the Conservative or the Liberal Democrat Party. They're doing very nicely.
Well, they may be. I mean, that may have something to do with the other side of things, the other side of the coin, which isn't orange. We are part of a coalition, you're right, and there is a collective responsibility, there's no doubt about it. But not all policies, as I say, I would agree with. I mean, I think the rich have to pay their fair share. In fact, if you look at the tax division, you probably find actually that the rich do pay quite a bit already. I know it may sound a bit controversial, but if you earn over £40,000 or £50,000, I mean, you're paying quite a lot of tax, and that in fact is the lion's share, as I understand it. So I think people on lower incomes need to pay less, and those on very high incomes, the mansion tax is what Minister Cable talked about, and that sort of thing. I think that makes sense.
Now, you've been a councillor for a couple of years,
yes.
Fairly new at it. How have you found it?
It's been interesting. The main thing of a councillor is to represent, obviously, his area and the residents in it and their interests. And I think that's what public service means. It is about bringing the council's attention. It's about bringing the council's services and investment to an area such as ours, which has seen regeneration and is in need, really, of a sustainable future.
But when you're fighting, surely, now, a rearguard action, since there's so many cuts coming in, much of what you're doing is coping with those cuts,
there
surely.
Are budget reductions and realignments, and the services at the front line are being maintained as best we can.
I mean, surely that's just simply not possible, is it? If £25 million is being cut from the budget, you cannot maintain frontline services.
Yes, you can. It depends where you target and how you do it. I think you'll find the city has its problems, certainly with reductions, but you have to manage that, and that's what the Cabinet are doing in the current administrations, Lib Dem administration, as you know. We're a minority of administration, but we are carrying out the policies that are for the interests of the people of Bristol.
So are you breathing a sigh of relief that there aren't any local elections this year?
No, we're in a fallow year, you're quite right. I mean, Bristol's standing thirds, and there is a move to, and there has been a move in full council to push it to all-out elections. But no, not breathing a sigh of relief. We will have to wait until the election of 2013, which is up, the next election for Bristol. And then 2014, we'll have to see what that brings.
OK, and what committees are you on?
I sit on public service and protection. I sit on licensing and quality of life.
And service and protection, what does that involve?
Yes, that deals with anything from applications for, say, burger vans, licensing for those, and of course taxis in the Bristol city, particularly the hackney carriages and private hire. It covers those, essentially.
Now, we've had quite a debacle at Temple Meads recently, with the taxi drivers saying, well, look, anyway, in a recession, we're not doing very well. And in the meantime, First Great Western imposing a new tax on us, actually up at Temple Meads, just to ply our trade. I mean, that's a bit of a difficult one, isn't it? Because they may have a right to do that, to have a kind of new tax to impose on the cab drivers, but it's in at a time when there simply isn't the money for them to pay it, surely.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, that's not a city council initiative or matter, but yes, I know what you're saying. I mean, there's bound to be a discussion between Temple Meads and the taxi drivers over that matter. I'm not privy to it myself, but in principle, there is a point to be made on both sides.
I suppose I'm really trying to find a way to talk a little bit about public transport, because it's a massive issue in the city, particularly with the slow... The first bus doesn't have the absolute monopoly that it used to have, but there's still a great deal of problems with people feeling that they're being really charged far too much to get around the city by public transport. And if you want to be in Green City, we have to have a functioning public transport system.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I think integrated transport policy is something that Bristol, you know, has looked at. But I mean, what you've got with the situation with the city buses is, regarding First and Wessex, is they're both private companies. Now, they bid for a license to run and operate in the city. They are not run by the city council. They are a for-profit company. And, you know, I have this in my ward where, you know, they will make decisions, possibly with some minor consultation, but they will make decisions that have consequences for residents. And it's quite difficult because... You know, they do maintain a subsidy from the council, obviously, but it doesn't give us the kind of, you know, say that perhaps the city would like to have. And I think it's important that the public understand that this is a private bus company run for profit. It is not run by the council. And indeed, I raised this issue for full council when I was raising a small subject in the scheme of things, perhaps, but the 41 bus in our ward that had been moved. From one road to another nearby, but it had consequences, and we're in the process of trying to get that reversed. But yes, they are. It is quite difficult at times. Transport across the city. There have been many improvements under our current cabinet member Tim Kent, and I think the BRT project and so forth. And there's been investment. I mean, you've seen the government are investing in transport in Bristol, you know, at the city council's request. So,
but the thing is, for example, with these new what they call showcase bus routes, what's happened is the bus stops have been shoved out into the road, so that it means that if you're a cyclist and you're trying to go past a bus, you're actually going straight into oncoming traffic. It also, I mean, the idea is that the bus at a bus stop acts like a giant roadblock, and so it gives the bus a priority, but it's actually really dangerous. Even the police have commented it's not good at all for road safety. So it sounds like it's backfired spectacularly.
I haven't seen this in practice actually working, and wouldn't want to comment in detail if they're public safety issues, they'll be looked at. I think I would say that.
Well, certainly I've heard them called bonkers bus stops. Anyway, we're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Now, we've had all sorts this week, but particularly I want to start with a little clip from the radio I recorded earlier this week, which is all about the way that quantitative easing is affecting our savings. This is one of the things, for example, during the budget, that the pensioners were stung. There's going to be more money taken in tax from pensioners over the years. And also QE. What is QE?
You're asking me now?
Yes, I am, to begin with. But then I think, because we've just heard from the IMF, they have given the Bank of England permission to do another massive tranche of this quantitative easing.
What it is a means of propping up the banking system, which is bankrupt, but they won't face the fact that it's bankrupt, so they're propping it up with funny money.
Is this like a sort of pit prop, just kind of keeping it upright when really it would otherwise fall over?
Absolutely.
Well, let's have a listen now to Dominic Laurie from the BBC explaining how these quantitative easing, you may want to pull over if you're driving and have a proper listen here, because it's actually quite complicated, but it will explain how quantitative easing actually totally erodes your savings.
Quantitative easing is new money. It's £325 billion worth of new money. So what that does, when you put the money into the system, you've got more money chasing the same amount of goods and services. The trouble is that causes the price of those goods and services to go up, because you've got more demand chasing the same amount of supply. So that's the one half of the equation. What it then also does is it lowers savings rates. That's because the quantitative easing money is used to buy government bonds largely. Demand for government bonds goes up, so the interest rate that those government bonds have to pay out is less. So when the interest rate that government bonds goes down, other types of interest rates go down as well, because they're all kind of locked in step. So you basically have lower savings rates and higher inflation. So people who rely on savings see their income just fall away, fall behind the cost of living, the inflation rate. That's the problem. Let's look at what could be done. It's about the savings rates that banks offer up. And what banks have had to do since 2008 is they've had to rebuild their profitability, rebuild their capital, because they've had a lot of loans go bad. So the way that they've done that is that all of us will have noticed that is the gap between the savings rates they pay out and the mortgage interest rates they offer borrowers has widened. For example, a typical savings rate is about 0.5%. If you go onto your bank or your building society, onto the website, their instant access saver will probably be about 0.5%. If you were then to try and take out a mortgage with that same bank or building society, not a historical tracker, which you might have done well at if you got 5 years ago, but one now, you might be offered about 5%, 4.5%. The gap between savings and borrowings is big on purpose by the banks at the moment because they feel weak and they need to rebuild their capital. So can you tell a bank to increase its savings rates, essentially lessen the difference between the savings and the borrowings rates, at a time where they still feel weak? It's extremely unlikely a bank would do that. Only in the last few weeks, we've seen several mortgage lenders actually increase their interest rates over the last few weeks, haven't we? And that's when the Bank of England base rate hasn't done anything for 3 years. So they obviously still feel weak. Go on the Best Buy tables. We, you know, there are lots of different ways to find the Best Buy tables. There are 3.5%, 3.25% rates out there. That is worth it because that is around and about the same level of inflation. You know, CPI inflation's around about there. That means that your savings are, woohoo, keeping in touch with the cost of living, the rising cost of living. That's about as good as we can hope for at the moment.
That was Dominic Laurie from the BBC there, at least making a pretty damn good attempt, I think, at explaining what's going on and why quantitative easing is massively affecting the return that we're getting from our savings in terms of income and in interest. Martin, this is only for people who've actually got savings, and of course, people don't necessarily have any savings.
Why
is it that all the time since... right way back to 2008, the banks are still feeling weak and they still feel
because
that they need...
Because they're bankrupt, and that's the real problem. Now, if people complain about quantitative easing, and I can see all the disadvantages of quantitative easing as we sit here, but without quantitative easing, the banks would have collapsed and people would have lost all their savings, because that can happen. It does happen. It's what happened in Argentina.
But if you're saying that the banks are actually bankrupt now, isn't this just staving off the inevitable, this?
I think it is. What happened when the 2008 crisis happened and new Labour was caught completely with its pants down, whereas they were dragged kicking and screaming down the road of nationalising various banks, starting off with Northern Rock. Now, once you've nationalised the banks, you should nationalise them and run them as a public enterprise. But what we're trying to do is resurrect them as private enterprises. So they've got to be made profitable so that the shareholders and the insiders can carry on taking home their shed loads of money, and everybody else has got to pay the price. So they're now trying to engineer a situation where everybody else pays the price to keep the private banks private. It's just insane. Ultimately, it will go down the drain, and then we will start talking seriously about what we need to do to reboot the economy. We are in a classic liquidity trap. As they pointed out there, the banks are borrowing money at 0.5% when inflation's at 3.5%, so they're actually getting money for free. And even there, even in those circumstances, they're not profitable, not seriously. And that is what's got to be faced up to, and that is what's going to have to change sooner or later. I mean, Vince Cable has hinted at it, and the Labour front bench have bottled it, but that is where we're going to have to go in the end.
Tim, I'm just going to ask for your comments on this, because a lot of people out there are wondering why we still have this situation where the government is trying, after 5 years now, still to rebuild these banks. There's still a big gap between the saving rate and the borrowing rate. And ultimately, everybody is paying for the bank's mistakes, all these bad loans in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem with... has been outlined, you know, the banks are trying to build their reserves, aren't they? And they're doing this, I know from experience, having talked to a local businessman who's actually doing some work in our ward. I mean, he's running a small building firm, and his own bank won't lend to him, and he's been with them 8 years. That's a knock-on effect of you know, the problems with the economy. I mean, they're just saying, no, you put up a lot more money to do this development, and we'll provide a lot less, and they're not going to take the risk.
Well, the banks have been given 5 years or so now to get themselves straight. They've also been given loads of public money. Yes. At what point do we say, right, we've had enough of time twiddling our thumbs waiting for you to sort things out, we're going to step in and do something like we've heard this week from the Argentinian government, is they've actually gone and nationalised part of their oil industry.
Well, of course.
When are we going to nationalise the banks and actually step in and even just simply use the shareholdings we already have in Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds?
You already have. I mean, you know, shareholders, the public, correct me if I'm wrong, already own several banks, and perhaps, you know, it is necessary for people to lobby their MPs and ask for things, you know, to be talked about and looked at and be done about this. There is a problem out there. The banks are not lending. It is difficult because the government message seems to be small business is good, let's see more small businesses, but the reality on the ground is, from my own experience and people I've talked to, there's one example I've given, but there could be problems with a contradictory situation on the ground.
Martin,
it is a problem.
What's the answer for the builder, Tim's friend in King's Weston?
Well, I mean, one simple answer is to stop public expenditure cuts, which of course are draining demand out of the economy, and as the banks then can't make any money, they refuse to lend, and then we quantitatively ease in order to try and keep them afloat. Now, we can actually save on quantitative easing by stopping public expenditure cuts, and I know this isn't the position of the Labour front bench. They are talking about, oh, well, there'd have to be some cuts. There is no case whatsoever for public expenditure cuts in this situation. None whatsoever. And I'm not saying that if we kept public expenditure up, we'd be out of the woods, because we wouldn't. Because the derivatives market is a massive bomb ready to go off. And of course, what they're trying to do is stop that bomb going off at the same time as looting everything that isn't nailed down. And if people call that capitalism, where people get meritocratic pay according to the contribution they make to the social product, it's not. It's just a scam. Pure and simple. And we've got a criminal ruling class, many of whom should be in prison. During the 1980s, in the savings and loan scandal, something like 3,000 top bankers in the US were sent to prison, proper prison. In the 1930s, several thousand bankers went to prison. Now, that's what has to happen. Of course, they can't then say, oh, if you raise taxes on me, I'm going to the Cayman Islands. You say, no, you're going to Wormwood Scrubs.
Well, that's an interesting prospect, but we can't even get the phone hackers into prison at the moment. But anyway, we'll no doubt come back to that again in future weeks. On to probably the biggest story of the week this week, which is Anders Breivik's trial in Norway. The killer refuses to detail his London Knights Templar visit. I think I'll ask you about this one to begin with, Martin, because one of the most important bits of evidence that's come out and through police interviews is this visit in 2002 that Breivik is alleged to have made to London to meet people from the far right, and one guy who was part of the founding members of the EDL and now apparently has nothing to do with the EDL. So what is this link all about?
Well, I find it very strange that Breivik is being allowed to defend himself in the way he's being allowed to defend himself, but we'll put that on one side and answer your direct question. What I am concerned about looking at something like this is, did this guy act alone, or did he have others working with him? And also, of course, did he have connections with the security services, like that guy that was shot dead in Toulouse a few weeks? It turned out he was a security services informer. And we're never going to find out what exactly his relationship with the security services is, because he's dead. Now, what's happening with the prosecution in this case in Norway? I think they're fluffing it, because they're trying to say that Breivik's telling us that he's got all these linkages with outside people, but we think he's a fantasist. That is not the way to go. What they should be doing is saying, well, who have you had linkages with? Tell us more, because we want to know who's behind this. It looks like a political hit. They killed 67 Labour Party young socialists, all teenagers. It's a political hit. It's not necessarily an individual. Olaf Palme, who was Prime Minister of Sweden, was murdered many years ago, and there's a very strong suspicions that that was carried out by Western intelligence services. Now, if people who listen to this show frequently will know that these are the kind of questions we ask. They're the kind of questions they ask in Belfast, and we ask them in Bristol.
Tim Leeman, Lib Dem councillor, what's your thoughts about the Breivik trial? It's a different culture over there. One of the things for me which is quite interesting is the way that he quite clearly was obsessed with this video game to get him into the sort of killing spree spirit. You know, well, it sounds as if, you know, potentially, you know, we should be looking at the access that young people have to these games.
Yeah, you I mean, I haven't followed this trial particularly closely, but I've seen the news and aware of the appalling loss of life. And there does seem to be a different sort of cultural approach to this, the way they've conducted the trial with the television cameras and what this man has been allowed to say. As I understand it, he's on trial for mass murder, really, which is what he committed. He's been given some voice, but yeah, there's the games link, I think, did come up, didn't it? That's quite worrying. I mean, video games has come up before as a problem and a potential catalyst for people carrying out things in real life that they've seen on a screen.
But what about this whole business of sort of the terror from the neo-Nazis from the far right? Because we've been almost trained, haven't we, to think that, well, if there's a terrorist, that person's going to be an Islamist, or, you know, that kind of terrorism is we're bombarded with day after day. But this is something rather new.
Yes, he's homegrown, isn't he? And that's probably different. He is a Norwegian, himself. And it's hard to understand where this is coming from, you know. But he's, as far as I know, again, it's perhaps a one-off. You know, you've got an individual who's decided to do this terrible act, you know, commit these terrible crimes, and undoubtedly he'll now go through due process and be tried by the court, and the consequences will probably last for years. But I wouldn't really want to comment too much more, I think.
Martin, what about this link with the EDL, at least an alleged link with this meeting in London, with forming something called the Knights Templar? Because they're a sort of notorious historical group, but certainly there is it seems that there is a link with this guy Lionheart, apparently, who was one of the founder members of the English Defence League.
Well, as I say, the prosecution seemed to be trying to downplay his links with outsiders and trying to suggest that he's...
Why might that be?
Because it may be that the Norwegian Secret Service are implicated in what we're looking at here, just as the French Secret Service are definitely implicated in what happened in Toulouse. As I say, these are the questions they ask in Belfast, and we ask them in Bristol.
OK, and also this week, the UK Labour Party has suspended Lord Nasir Ahmed for announcing a bounty, allegedly anyway, on Bush and Obama. Labour Party of Britain suspended the membership of Lord Nasir over media reports. However, Lord Nasir denied all of those media reports. Apparently, he offered a £10 million or $15 million bounty for the capture of US President Barack Obama. According to reports during a recent visit to Pakistan, Lord Nasir, a member of the British House of Lords, who originally hails from Kashmir, announced he was putting up a bounty for the capture of Obama and George W. Bush. Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously this is causing embarrassment to the Labour leadership, but in actual fact, in Pakistan itself, where drones kill civilians every day, where Raymond Davis, the CIA agent, shot dead two Pakistanis on motorbikes who may have been the police shadowing him, and they looked at his mobile phone and saw that he was in contact with all sorts of terrorist groups inside Pakistan, and there are many people of Pakistani origin in Bristol who know what I'm talking about. The idea that the United States and Britain do not engage in international terrorism is risible. Absolutely risible. Ask the Pakistani police, ask the Pakistani army, ask the Pakistani people. Now, that I'm not justifying any kind of terrorism by anybody, but people have got to wake up and smell the cordite. We are not regarded in most of the rest of the world as team players when it comes to tracking down terrorists, and that's just a fact.
Tim, one of the things that Lord Ahmed has said in his defence is, I did not offer a bounty. I said there have been war crimes committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those people who have got strong allegations against them, that is George W. Bush and Tony Blair, have been involved in illegal wars and should be brought to justice, he said. It sounds to me like there may have been something lost in the translation.
Yes, it does look that way, doesn't it? I mean, did you say he was a Labour peer? Well, there you go. I mean, it's up to him what he decides to do. judging by the reaction, it probably wasn't recommended.
Okay, on to a maybe related topic, and this is about Abu Qatada. There's been a big fuss about whether he should be deported to Jordan this week. But I thought I'd find out, because there's been so much discussion about whether or not he should go, that I thought I'd find out who this guy is and what he's supposed to have done. His real name is Omar Othman, and he is a Palestinian-Jordanian Islamic scholar who was born in Bethlehem. He came to the UK in 1993 and is among a large group of Islamists who fled from the Middle East to London as they faced persecution over there. Abu Qatada is an influential supporter of the Mujahideen causes. He's accused of threatening British national security by supporting terrorism, something that he denies. He's never been charged with any offence in the UK, but has been held in detention and had his movements restricted by control orders because he was suspected of playing a role in radicalisation. Martin.
Well, this question of who these people really are is a serious question, isn't it? This guy is wanted in Jordan, supposedly. Now, who elects the government of Jordan? Oh, hang on a minute. They're one of those terrorist regimes like Libya, aren't they? Which we've just bombed to pieces and put in... And like in Syria, where people are... Are they terrorists? Are they freedom fighters?
But you tell me. Surely they're friendly to us, the Jordanians.
Ah, and of course, one of the reasons why we've got a lot of these so-called Islamic extremists in Britain is because MI6 were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone in the 1980s when we trained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We took all the nutters from all over the Middle East, from Jordan, from Libya, from elsewhere. They were trained by our own special forces and infiltrated into Afghanistan. That's why they're all here, folks, because they've all got links to our own intelligence services. They always have had.
Tim, what about this? There's been a bit of big fuss about Abu Qatada this week, especially a bit of egg on the face of the Home Secretary getting the day wrong where she thought that there could be an appeal launched by him. What are your thoughts?
I like the analysis there. It's kind of interesting. I mean, the thing that struck me about it, I suppose, watching the news item, was the fact the government were in a bit of... there was an argument over whether he'd missed the deadline for his appeal, you know. And, of course, there's, you know, can he be extradited, can he not? And I suppose that's the sort of embarrassment factor in all this, which always, you know, is the thing that comes out. And that seems to be more important than the actual news of who this guy is. But clearly he, you know, the report says that who is he? And I don't think we really know. I think, you know, it's probably more to come out about that.
If there's no case to answer against him, we have habeas corpus in this country, or we did, and we had since 1215. And if they haven't got any evidence against him, they must release him. End of discussion. Otherwise, we're not got a rule of law here.
But he's been described as a hate preacher.
So what? That's irrelevant. Unless, if you, in that case, charge him with being a hate preacher under the Race Relations Act and make it stick. And if you can't make it stick, release him.
Okay, Evening Post Spirit of 1932 lives on to this day. At least that's the headline in the Evening Post. It's not called the Evening Post anymore, it's called The Post. Maybe I can ask you, Tim, if you've seen the new edition of the local paper, and what do you think?
I think I may have done, yeah. It's I haven't looked through it, I think I had a brief look today and just caught my eye that it perhaps changed. I mean, perhaps as a reinvention, a redefining of itself, trying to attract new readers, you know, by giving itself a new name. I hope it works for them, if that's what they're trying to do.
It's slightly embarrassing timing in that last end of last week they just announced another 20 redundancies.
Yes, I've heard they've announced journalist redundancies, as you say, of about 20. I'm not privy to those details, of course, but difficult times for businesses. I guess it could be they are again perhaps a victim of the recession.
Martin, there was also a protest on Tuesday outside the Evening Post's birthday exhibition in the galleries. Are you surprised that the Evening Post themselves didn't report it?
No, not really. I mean, that's why Al Jazeera doesn't report what's going on in Bahrain, because they're in cahoots with the Bahraini royal family.
OK, well, let's go down to 6:30, roughly, on Tuesday, go down to the galleries to hear a little report from the protest that I did.
The Post was founded in 1932 by the Bristol community in defiance at Northcliffe's attempt to win a Bristol monopoly for its title, The Bristol World. 6 years ago, there were close to 190 journalists on the Post, Western Daily Press and Observer. After this cull, there'll be fewer than 40.
My name is Susie Weldon, and I was a journalist at the Western Daily Press, which is a sister paper of the Bristol Evening Post, is owned by the same Northcliffe group. And I'm here because I'm devastated to hear the news that a city the size of Bristol is going to lose its Saturday edition, and that so many jobs are going. When you look at how many people were employed by the Post even just 6 years ago, and how many will be employed after these cuts, it is devastating for Bristol. We are living in tough times, but I think you have to look at how much money is still being made in the newspaper business. Regional news, yes, we're in very serious times, and people have to change their business structure, but they're not going to win by cutting journalists. What kind of service are they going to be able to offer? Even fewer people will be interested in reading the paper if they're not able to hold people like the local council, local officials to account.
His family fortune is £730 million, and yet he makes his journalists redundant. Let's say no to this fat cat. Say no to both our brother Mayor. Come out here and join us.
£730 million personal fortune, but he still has to sack journalists, Tim.
Yes, I mean, I would say the commentary there, the commenter said that, you know, the Evening Post was holding the needed to hold the council to account. It is the opposition within the council that holds the administration to account, not the Evening Post directly. And I think you know, we need to be aware of that.
But doesn't it? I mean, it informs the public, who then vote in an opposition.
Well, it'll be their perspective on things, clearly, which is fine. I mean, you know, newspapers do publish stories all the time with their perspective. But I think, yeah, I had no idea there was so much money involved in newspapers. I thought they were on much harder times, but I'm not sure that their profits are relevant to the actual, you know, whatever their business model might be. I don't know.
But I mean, they made this is the most recently filed accounts for Bristol News and Media, which is the Evening Post and Western Daily Press, operating profit of £1.5 million, the most recent one up to the end of last year. But so, I mean, the question really is, that profit, should it be reinvested into the paper?
Yes,
into journalism.
Does it beg the question,
or should it go to the shareholders?
Well, it's not for me to decide, because I'm not a shareholder and I'm not not in a position. But I would say, you know, if you're taking it at face value, I can see where you're coming from. I'm sure people would see where you're coming from in terms of money, but it may not be as simple as that. And as I say, I'm not a shareholder and I'm not.
You know, I think it's interesting you say that, because we were talking about Temple Meads earlier. We were talking about the buses, and now we're talking about the Evening Post. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that liberals do say, it's private property, and what can I do? I'm a socialist, and actually I think that Temple Meads station ought to be owned by either the Bristol City Council or National Rail. I think the local buses were much better managed when they were run by local authorities. And, if the Evening Post, if we want the Evening Post, we might have to decide that we want to pay for it, or make Northcliffe pay for it. Because, of course, the business model is we're going to squeeze as much out of these people as possible and give as little back as we can. And, of course, she's quite right, the journalist. Eventually, people are not going to read something which is just a load of adverts. And in fact, the other problem that we've got in journalism is that, certainly at national level, advertising revenues are going down. We lost the Clevedon Mercury the other day. This is part of the general problem of the recession, but not for this newspaper.
Now, one of the first untruths you will read when you open a copy of the new Post is the paper all Bristol called for and helped to create, because the opposite is actually the case. The paper we see today is owned by Northcliffe, which is part of Lord Rothermere's Daily Mail empire. The Bristol Evening Post was set up in 1932 by public subscription in an appeal led by the Bishop of Malmesbury. It was formed as an independent Bristol-owned paper precisely to compete with the Northcliffe paper of its day, the Evening World, which it eventually outsold. So let's not forget also that Rothermere supported the Nazis in the 1930s, along with many of our German ancestry royalty, such as Edward VIII, who had changed his name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor during the First World War. Anyway, shares in the original 1932 Bristol Evening Post were gradually bought up by Lord Rothermere's son in the 1970s, and by the 80s he began to demand places on the board and took the Bristol Evening Post back under Rothermere control. But that was only after the Bristol owners and chairman Walter Hawkins had died. Well, Walter's wife is still alive and lives up in Alverston on the way to Thornbury, and I spoke to her recently about her husband Walter and how the character of the Bristol Evening Post has changed since it was retaken over in the 80s by Rothermere's Northcliffe newspapers.
The Evening World and the Evening Post were competitive, and there came a time when there wasn't really room in Bristol for two evening newspapers. So there was always this sort of enmity between them. They sold about the same at one point, and then the Evening Post sold a few more. But the Evening World was not owned by anybody in Bristol. It was owned by Rothermere's. Les Rothermere was the first Northcliffe newspaper man, and he was Walter's contemporary. It seemed sort of, you know, that they couldn't really get on together. There just wasn't any business for both of them. The Evening World tried sort of funny tricks because they said at one time that they were saying that their circulation was twice that of the Evening Post, but some spy discovered that they were putting half their sort of printing down in a place down in Somerset and burning it. Husband. His father was director of the Evening Post, chairman and director. Herbert Hawkins, his grandfather was Walter Hawkins the First. He founded the Bristol Postboy in Bristol, and then which was inherited by Herbert Hawkins, who then brought up his family in Bristol, in Redland, and Walter was the one son, and then got a job in the Evening Post, and his father said, you can learn to be a, you know, a newspaper man. It's a very old building and rather creaky. He regarded his staff as more like his, not his servants, his family. And I remember the staff were very important in his life to him, and he treated them like his brothers. The staff knew that if they went upstairs, they could knock on the door and he'd always talk to them about anything. And they'd never had this with anyone else before, and with none of the other directors, really. And that was how he was, and he'd always talk to anybody, no appointments, anything. And I remember once in Silver Street, there was a flood from some or other pipe or other, that something had gone wrong during the night, and the whole of the printing room, which was down in the cellar, they cast the metal down there to make the plates to print from. And somebody came up and said, one of the foundry people, he went up and he said, who's that funny man who is down there in Wellington boots sweeping out the water? And so this fellow said, well, that's the managing director. He was managing director then. And he was that sort of person, you know, hands-on, very much keen. And he got this from his father, really. I mean, his father and his grandfather were all in newspapers, you see. They passed the thing on. The old Lord Rothermere said he would buy enough shares in the Evening Post, but he had a gentleman's agreement that he would never buy more, the one below or whatever it was, you know. But of course, eventually, because they had so many shares, one of the directors of Associated Newspapers, which was Rothermere's firm, Walter was older then and had retired, and so had Lord Rothermere died, and then his son took over, and he was then Lord Rothermere, you see. But he insisted, because they had so many shares, that one of the Daily Mail would sit on the board of the Evening Post, and they didn't think this was very harmful, you know, because they always had a very good friendship with them. And so that's what happened. Well, then as the years went on and Walter retired, they had another one. They had two people on the Evening Post, and they did have one try at taking over. They had all these sort of Bristol people came to the AGM and refused. When it came for the takeover, there were actually some people, wives came, whose husbands had died and had left them the shares in the Evening Post, and they still had them. An awful lot of people came and said that, you know, they'd got these 100 shares at the time. The takeover was by the Rothermere, by the Daily Mail. It was after Walter died, you know, in the 1980s.
That was Joan Hawkins there, who lives up in Alverston on the way up to Thornbury, talking about her husband Walter Hawkins, who was I think quite possibly the last Bristol managing director of the Bristol Evening Post, before that is whilst it was still the paper all Bristol called for and helped to create, and not bought up by the Northcliffe Empire again. Tim, I mean, isn't this inevitable, all of this, really, because the internet's taking over and people are getting the news that way?
Yeah, I mean, can I just comment, that was quite a delightful story, actually, we were listening to there, kind of, you know, historical reminiscing. Yeah, I mean, the internet is a factor, and we were just saying in the break that, you know, the problem with the internet is it's not turned out to be as profitable for companies as they thought, and you know, circulations are in decline, and it's survival, isn't it? You know, we're going to end up with fewer and fewer players, and they're going to be wanting to make profit out of a small market, and that's the problem, isn't it? It's an ever decreasing circle of market share.
Okay, now Prime Minister's Questions is back this week after the Easter break. The House of Commons are sitting again, and one of the most interesting people who popped their head up at Prime Minister's Questions was the new MP, George Galloway.
Sir George Galloway!
As I was saying, Mr. Speaker, there is an ironclad consensus across the three front benches about what they now call a mission, but given the amount of blood on the ground and the rapidly deteriorating military situation, most of us call a war in Afghanistan. In the wake of Mrs. Gillard's decision to accelerate the withdrawal of Australian forces from that war, and in the wake of the Bradford West by-election, will the Prime Minister reconsider his current planning on our withdrawal from this maw, this bloody maw of Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate the Honourable Gentleman on his stunning by-election victory and his return to this House of Commons. And I know he always speaks with great power and great force. But on this issue, I have to say I profoundly disagree with him. Our troops are in Afghanistan, not fighting a war against Islam, but at the invitation of an Islamic government and under a UN resolution to try and help that country to have a peaceful, prosperous and stable future. And he knows the dangers in the past of walking away from Afghanistan and leaving that country to become the terrorist-supporting haven that it did under the Taliban. We mustn't make that mistake again. And I would urge him not to play to the gallery on this issue, but to speak up for the work our forces are doing to make Afghanistan a safer country.
Tim, what do you make of George Galloway there?
Well, George Galloway, yes, I like George. I must I used to listen to his show on 5 Live before he's just become an MP again.
It was on TalkSport, which is on medium wave. And actually, right. He's been all of the talk other than sport on TalkSport has been got rid of about 3-4 weeks before the by-election. But anyhow.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he doesn't change his approach to politics from what I've heard. He's very open and but I disagree with his politics essentially.
What about this whole business of Afghanistan? He's saying it's not really a mission, it is a war, it's a failure, we should just do what the Australians are doing and just slowly pull out.
Well, the government stated its position, but you know, if you do that, you could be opening yourself up to you know, it's been said, you could be opening yourself up to the problem of you know, of leaving a situation half undone. Yes, I wouldn't like to say too much about it. It's not an area of expertise for me, but I do understand there are different points of view. I would say that much. I do understand that.
Yeah, well, I think talking to army contacts that I have, they realise that it's hopeless at every level.
But doesn't it mean, surely, if you've got a purpose of being there, you should carry on?
Well, Karzai, let's remember who Karzai is. He packed the ballot boxes. So this guy who's our ally, who has actually already said he wants everybody in their bases and back home as soon as, although the British and the Americans don't want to listen to him, he didn't win that election. It was a fraudulent election, far more fraudulent than the elections in Iran, for example. So the guy's got no credibility whatsoever. His brother, Wali Karzai, who was assassinated by the Taliban about a year ago, was named by the DEA as the top drug dealer in Afghanistan, even though he's on the CIA payroll. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the 1980s. We've been sticking our finger into Afghanistan for over 30 or 40 years. The amount of British money that's been spent on killing Afghans is obscene. And in actual fact, people in the Muslim world are fed up with our cant and hypocrisy about all of this. People in Pakistan are being murdered by drones which are being flown from Afghanistan. And ultimately, why they're in Afghanistan is because they want to threaten the Chinese and they want to build a pipeline through Helmand Province. But they can't do that because they can't control Helmand Province. Now, this is the reality of the situation. This is power politics of the 19th century kind with 21st century weapons. The British people have already seen through it. The political class are still coming out with the rubbish. But it doesn't matter what they say. Doesn't matter what they say, the Taliban IEDs now are absolutely undetectable. They've realised that. That's game over. You're defeated.
Last weekend there was a massive attack by the insurgents and the Taliban on the capital, Kabul, Martin, that took almost 18 hours to quell, one of the biggest ever attacks and most audacious and well coordinated, apparently. There were three other eastern provinces, simultaneous attacks as well, so it doesn't look as if it's over yet.
Well, it's not going to be over. If we withdraw, the fighting will continue, because we've basically set it up to continue as we set it up in the 1980s. The Najibullah government, which was supported by the Russians, managed to survive for 3 years after the Russians had pulled out, because it did have some popular support. Karzai hasn't got any. But of course, what we've done is we've made the place a misery for years. It's a disgrace. It's a shame on this country's honour. And the soldiers who are dying out there, I've got every sympathy for them. But don't forget, your American allies, while you're being blown up by Taliban IEDs, are rampaging around drunk, raping and murdering. Now, at some point, you've got to draw the line under it and cut your losses. That moment has come. The Australians have realised it.
Tim, this has been going on for a long time, this Afghanistan thing, but I'm going to give you the final word on it.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, support the armed forces in their quest. I mean, I've actually served in the Royal Signal, so I've had some experience of the military, and that is my position, I think, that, you know, no matter what happens, we need to support the guys who are doing the job on the ground. They've been tasked, they've performed extraordinarily well. I think we can all see that, and we hear it every day. Yes, let's, you know, when they come home, we will celebrate. I think that's all you can say, and they will have done a good job, I've no doubt.
So that was Prime Minister's questions to George Gallery, stirring things up, as he always does. Now, back to Prime Minister's questions, and this time, let's have a listen to one of the exchanges between Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, and David Cameron.
Mr. Speaker, in case he's very excited today, Mr. Speaker, in case he's forgotten, it's Prime Minister's questions. The clue's in the name. I ask the questions, and he's supposed to answer them. No answer on pensioners. No answer on families. What about charities? The Prime Minister's big idea was the big society. But since the budget, I don't know why he's taking advice from the part-time Chancellor sitting next to him, I wonder which job he's doing today, Mr. Speaker. But since the budget, the government has managed to insult people who give to charity, and he's insulted the charities themselves by implying they're bogus. Now, the Prime Minister claimed he worked on the budget line by line. Did he know when he signed off the budget that it represented a hit of as much as £500 million on Britain's charities?
These figures are completely wrong, but let me tell the Right Honourable Gentleman, first of all, absolutely no defence of Ken Livingstone, not a word. And what this is all about is making sure that the richest people in our country do pay their taxes. Now, last year, there were over 300 people earning over £1 million who paid a rate of tax of 10%. I don't think that's good enough. And we've got a Labour candidate for Mayor of London who's paying less tax on his earnings than the person who cleans his office. I think that's disgraceful. Why won't he condemn it?
Well, the hoo-ha is back again. Martin, I know you're not a big fan of Prime Minister's questions, but it did seem there that David Cameron simply wasn't answering the questions. I mean, what is the point of having a Prime Minister's questions when he's just saying, well, you've got your figures wrong, and then he goes on and starts asking questions of the leader of the opposition?
Well, that's why I don't like Prime Minister's questions. You put your finger on it. Basically, people say what they want to say. It demeans politics. I used to live in Poland, and I worked in the Polish Parliament with my colleagues there, and it's like watching paint dry. But they're getting on with the job. That's not getting on with the job, it's a joke.
Isn't it Speaker's job to make sure that the questions are actually answered rather than just avoided?
Ultimately, in Britain, what you've got is the Prime Minister's got all power. So this is the only time of the week when he gets baited. But in the Polish Parliament, where they're making coalitions all the time, because they've got PR, there's an awful lot of horse trading going on, which is carried out in a very different tone of voice from that, I can tell you.
Yes, I mean, a certain amount of pantomime goes on, doesn't it, in the parliamentary debate of Prime Minister's questions. I suspect there's a good deal going on behind the scenes, as often happens in these things. With regard to the charitable, I think the big argument is over the actual taxing of charitable donations. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think no, it
that's
is.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I mean, that does seem to be something you sort of play with at your peril, from what I've heard. I mean, Tony Blair was on television. I mean, we haven't seen him for a crop up for a while. And he, you know, and Tony Blair was obviously saying that, you know, I wouldn't go down this road. So he's had some experience of government, he was saying, in this, you know, particular area. And I think it's always risky when you start talking about taxing people on charitable donations. I mean, they, you know,
but it's not good for the big society. That's the point Ed Miliband's making.
It's
there.
Not
he's
good
saying,
for charities, actually.
He's saying if you're going to rely on a big society, charities need to be helped, not taxed.
I would say no more than I've said. I think it's, you know, if you're going to tax charitable donations, think about it before you do it, I think is the question.
I think this whole question of whether charities are bogus or not is a serious one. I used to work in the former Soviet Union, and the mafia used to use charities to avoid tax all the time. But that's for the charity commissioners, isn't it? If charities are bogus, like Werity and Fox's little charity, Atlantic Bridge, which was said, this isn't a charity, this is just a private... that's for the charity commissioners.
This is the former Defence Secretary.
Indeed.
What on earth was that charity doing there, Martin? Can you just expand on that a bit?
The charity commissioners moved in on it and said, this isn't a proper charity. You know, because charities, they spent most of their money on freebies and trips and so on. Now, charities can be campaigning, like Oxfam. I remember Oxfam in the 80s. They had a lot of grief because they wanted to campaign against apartheid in South Africa. But the charity commission has ultimately said that's within your charitable brief to do that. But they also had to set up Oxfam campaigns had to be separate from Oxfam, you know, Oxfam proper and so on. This is for the charity commissioners. Just saying to people who are giving charitable donations, if it's more than 500,000, then you've got to pay tax on it, is a kick in the teeth for legitimate charities that are trying to do things. And of course, it's not joined up government, is it? On the one hand, we're going to have charities taking over everything, and on the other hand, we're not going to give them any money. Sounds like virtually the rest of the economic policy, frankly.
Well, I see you nodding there, Tim. Right, on to the stand up and be counted. George Ferguson kickstarts the Bristol Mayor debate. Well, the Bristol Mayor debate has been going on for a little bit longer than that. But architect George Ferguson has started the debate over an elected mayor for Bristol by becoming the first candidate to throw his hat into the ring for the post. The former High Sheriff, who founded the tobacco factory in Southville and the canteen on Stokes Croft, wants the issue to become a major talking point for a referendum on May the 3rd. Well, there's only about 2 weeks to go on this one, Tim Lehman, Lib Dem councillor. So what's your thoughts on the whole
thing? Well, I'm actually not in favour. And there's several reasons. I mean, the cost is one. I mean, you know, they won't have any additional powers. There's no Greater Bristol involved, so you're not going to be able to influence necessarily outside the city. And I think the city has its own identity. It has a clear history. It doesn't need a bolt-on personality who's going to, you know, what's going to happen to councillors. I mean, we represent our wards, and you could upset democracy. You could get some kind of dictatorship out of it, almost, representing specific interests. I think it's a worry, and I think it's not going to do the city a power of good. I don't see that a personality is what we need. We have a leader, we have a cabinet, we have a party system. It works perfectly well. And I mean, to pay up to £1 million to have someone, you know, to do a lot of publicity and other things, I don't think is really going to work.
So the argument is, it's common sense. If one person is in charge, then they can actually get things done. The current system as too bureaucratic.
No, you're putting all you're filtering all the decision making and policy making and through one person. And, you know, they will have, what will they do? Will they be part-time? Will they be a business person? You know, I've had people come to me and say, oh, yes, the council should be run as a business. No, it should not. It, you know, entirely. I mean, the council already, you know, employs contractors and private contractors, but there are elements of the service of the council that have to be relied upon. It's a public service. It's funded through taxpayers.
But so you don't agree at all with this argument that actually the council at the moment is too bureaucratic?
Oh, well, there may well be some argument about bureaucracy. There always is. You know, it's too bureaucratic. There's too many people, you know, involved. Yes, there's bound to be some bureaucracy in all local government. There has to be. I'm not sure I can comment that there's too much in there. I think that's controversial. So I'll leave it at that, if I may.
Well, I agree with all of that. And the other thing that strikes me is that we've got no local elections in Bristol this May. And our activists won't be out knocking on doors, and nor will yours.
This is very true.
And it's very likely that we're going to get a turnout, I guess, in the region of around 20%. And on the back of that, we could then get, say, 11% who vote for an elected mayor, mostly in Clifton, I bet you. and then we will end up with an elected mayor whether we like it or not. And as I said at the debate last Friday about this on College Green, perhaps the No campaign should just call for a boycott, because of course when we were doing the referendum in Ireland, in Scotland and in Wales, you had to get 50% plus one. In fact, 55% in Scotland. So the devolution referendum failed in 1979 because they won it, but they didn't win it by enough. But this is just going to be foisted on us by central government, and we're going to be told we're being empowered. It's management.
The other thing which I'm a bit bothered about is the fact that we've got this article all about George Ferguson launching his campaign, but nowhere in there anywhere does it mention that he's one of the Society of Merchant Venturers, which is obviously a very big business.
I think it's very important as to who you get and what direction of travel they want to go in and what their stall will be. You know, to run a city this size, it takes an awful lot of hard work from an awful lot of people. And I think, you know, one person coming up and saying, you know, I'm going to do it, and in my own image, is probably not the answer.
Okay, that's you just heard there, Tim Leeman, Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston. After the news, it started this week, but why does it take a foreign TV channel to give Julian Assange his own talk show? bcfm.org.uk. BCFMU.